This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
The World Health Organization, as well as the Mental Health Commission of Canada, have endorsed the transformation of mental health care based on a recovery model that promotes consumer empowerment and involvement in service delivery. But changing institutional culture to promote and include meaningful dialogue between those who are being treated and those providing the treatment is challenging. Some recent research has brought together service recipients and service providers in a project that looked at how treatment dialogue might be implemented. Rana Schwartz is an occupational therapist and a coordinator in the Early Psychosis and Schizophrenia Spectrum Program at McGill University Health Center in Montreal. Rana was the lead researcher for a study looking at how dialogue between mental health consumers and care providers could promote recovery-oriented care in an institutional setting. The 2013 study is called Mental Health Consumers and Providers Dialogue in an Institutional Setting, a Participatory Approach to Promoting Recovery-Oriented Care. People First Radio's Nancy McInnes spoke with Rana Schwartz about that study. Here's their discussion.
Welcome, Rana Schwartz, to People First Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You're part of the Early Psychosis and Schizophrenia Spectrum Program at the McGill University Health Center. What population do you work with there?
I work both with people who've have had psychotic disorders for many years, but primarily with first episode or people in the very early stages of a psychotic illness. I also have an administrative role, a coordinator role, coordinating, you know, the programming in the whole clinic.
So what ignited your interest in the topic of caregiver-patient dialogue as a way to improve outcomes in institutional mental health care?
It's been brewing or igniting for probably many, many years. I think it started when I was working in a hospital in the community where I was living. I saw in the hospital actually have important roles in the community. And I started to become interested in, like I said, in what makes people heal or what makes people get better, but also, you know, why certain people get better and what were the conditions that promoted that level of recovery. So I started to question some of the practices, the sort of traditional practices in mental health that were sort of more focused on the expertise of the professionals. And I started to just become interested in the perspective of the patients in terms of what really helps them and to try and to create those conditions in the actual sort of institutional settings, which has been pretty challenging, actually.
Mm-hmm. So how much support would you say is there in Canada for the use of a recovery model of promoting consumer empowerment and involvement?
I think it's starting to change. I think that certainly recovery is part of the global mental health strategy of the federal strategy, and it's part of the provincial, certainly in Quebec, it's part of the provincial strategy as well. To shift it from the conceptual or the rhetoric part of recovery to the actual implementation, it takes a lot of different forces, and some of them are at the level of policy, but some of them are at the level of doing what I think what we were trying to do is just start having local change, having people dialogue about trying to shift practices and shift belief systems. And I think they're both important. So there is policy in place that we're supposed to be recovery-oriented, but I think, you know, at the local level, it involves more than that. It involves people being exposed to different realities and different attitudes and seeing people actually at different stages in their recovery.
There's a lot invested, I think, in the different roles in the mental health system. And reading the report from your study, I could see that both the consumers and the providers have to be willing to take a risk. a fairly large risk to begin to shift things.
It is a fairly large risk. We were quite fortunate in our study that we had a small group of people that were invested in wanting to look both at themselves and at practices that were taking place. In very traditional sort of organizations that are quite hierarchical, that becomes more challenging, obviously. And risk-taking has many obstacles, especially in psychiatry, where there's could be potentially very difficult consequences attached to risk. But the point of the research is not to create kind of guidelines of how to assess risk or when to accept or not accept different risk behaviors. The point of the research was that we need mechanisms in place to talk about it, to talk about sensitive issues and to talk about both provider and consumer reactions to different things that are going on. I think that's the idea, is that sometimes we're afraid to just talk about difficult things, and things will never change unless we can create processes for that level of dialogue to happen.
For people that haven't read the report of your research, can you explain the process that you used?
We were a group of about 10 people, 9 or 10 people, that included practitioners, occupational therapists, primarily because we were responsible for providing a lot of the rehabilitation programming. We had one psychiatrist and one academic researcher, and we also had a group of service users or consumers who I had worked with, actually, who were interested in moving from the role of being a helpy to being a helper, and they wanted to make some changes in the system. So there was this sort of organic process that happened where people were interested in looking at practice and trying to change practice. We had a funding opportunity to look at recovery-oriented care and rehabilitation, and so that allowed us to do this research project. And the purpose of the research was to look at how we can create sort of a shared construction or a shared definition of what recovery-oriented care was, because there's already a lot of studies that look at recovery-oriented care from the perspective of the consumers and of the providers, but it's rarely done together and in dialogue so that perceptions can actually shift in the context of dialogue. So we got together and we created a process where we would get together for 90 minutes a week, and we recorded the sessions, and we had themes that were chosen by the group members themselves in terms of what was important in their own recovery. Every week, people would come in with different narratives related to those themes. Like I said, we recorded the sessions, and then as a group, we looked at what types of values were elicited from the different stories, because stories are very good at showing what's important to people in their care and in providing care. We looked at the stories themselves, and we looked at different themes and the different values that came out. We put those themes together. After a few months, we took the most salient themes, and we sort of made a summary of what emerged from the group, and then we presented it to the organization to disseminate the results. That was sort of like a very quick and dirty summary of what happened. But in the process of doing that, many other things happened. It wasn't a seamless process. There was a lot of issues related to trust and community building and power and privilege, and there was a lot of conflict, and there was there was painful things that happened as well. So that also helped to inform our process.
I don't know how you can make a major transition without those sort of things.
That's true.
I was taken with, in your results section of the brief report that I had, it says, consumers frequently voice stories about feeling misunderstood and emphasize the need for their experiences rather than their symptoms to be acknowledged. For example,
Exactly. If
you're a crazy person and you scream, that's all they hear is the scream, and you're pathologized for being angry and having an emotion.
That was very much underscored in the research, and also, it's something that we hear all the time, but that's the reality. I mean, it is an unfortunate reality of a medical system that has to sort of take people's experiences and put them in different types of frameworks in order to provide treatment and to have some type of shared language. most providers, even though they're very, they offer a lot of empathy and they're very much interested in the patients, there's also this pressure to take what people are saying and to put them into different, you know, sort of codifying languages. Mm-hmm. And that has unfortunately, it has a very insidious effect on the consumers, because they don't feel like their stories are really being listened to. They're being primarily categorized. That was discussed quite a bit, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's quite dehumanizing if you're in the system for a long time.
Yeah.
And that had a profound impact on the providers as well, to hear that.
It says here, one provider reflected, "I'm more confused and frustrated now, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes we're clear because our beliefs haven't been challenged."
And it's also a great quote from someone that has, I guess, the openness to want to be able to look at their own behavior and have it criticized. But I'm not sure that that's the case, unfortunately, not always the case for everybody. So sometimes we tend not to want to, we like things to be neat and mm-hmm. to not have them questioned. The whole experience was very destabilizing for both consumers and providers. And it still is, because we're still a group and we still are in the process of doing other projects, and we still go through very painful experiences for that reason, because it forces us to sometimes look at things that we don't really want to see.
Mm-hmm. So we just have a moment left. Is there any last thing you'd like to share?
I guess the take-home message from that project, and for me, is that, and my hope, is that we do somehow create conditions for safe dialogue to happen, because I don't think mental health can move forward without that.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. It's much appreciated.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rhonna Schwartz is the coordinator in the Early Psychosis and Schizophrenia Spectrum Program at McGill University Health Center in Montreal. She spoke with People First Radio's Nancy McInnes in March 2014. Because that interview was first broadcast a year ago, I contacted Rhonna Schwartz a couple of days ago to ask if she could update our information about the project. She told me by email that, and quote, "Unfortunately, there are no further findings related to this research, as additional funds were not available to continue formal studies. However," Rhonna continues, "I think it would be fair to say that the project was responsible for the development of an innovative committee involving users, providers, family members, volunteers, and administrators that meets regularly to dialogue about care. There's also a slowly developing sensitivity to the importance of knowledge based on lived experience, as well as the need to honor the challenges faced by mental health care providers who face bureaucratic and institutional demands." That update came in a March 17th, 2015 email from Rhonna Schwartz.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.